Welcome to the RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. I'm a GP in London, also an academic at King's College with an interest in early cancer diagnosis. And I also have a role at the RCGP where I'm one of the education leads. And today I'm talking to Professor Willie Hamilton. Hi, Willie.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me to join you.
Willie, I'm sure many people will know you, but you're Professor of Cancer Diagnostics and Primary Care at the University of Exeter. Obviously, you've had a long career within primary care research. Just tell us a bit about your sort of background and why you got interested in this area.
Thanks, Tom. In fact, it was almost by chance. I was a budding academic GP without really a subject area to attach to. And then I saw a Department of Health call to try and improve identification of cancer symptoms. And it was an area I felt I could contribute to. I applied for the money, not realizing it was for real big people who knew what they were talking about. And I was completely surprised to get the grant. And it worked. And from then on, the subject has just mushroomed, Tom. So as usual, chance, but then run with your chance when it works.
Yeah, and so many people will be aware of your role in the NICE guidelines, and we call you the father of PPV, or positive predictive value, from a lot of your papers. I mean, is that, you want to give us a bit of background as to how that started and how that changed things?
Yeah, that's a lovely term. I've never said that to my face before. I mean, I think the whole background of PPVs was for some of the listeners who aren't completely happy with that term, it's a positive predictive value. It's the chance of you having cancer when you have the feature that we're describing. So if I cough up blood now and report it to Tom and his surgery, my chance of having lung cancer is 2.4% based on one of my studies. We realized at quite an early stage that GPs were actually selecting patients for investigation for cancer, and specialists were selecting patients for definitive investigation based on the actual risk of cancer. That was all done subliminally. And we changed it from being subliminal to being overt. And then we changed the NICE guidance in 2015 to being in the guidance. And we were the first country in the world to do that, to be quite explicit that we will select patients for investigation based on the precise risk of them having cancer.
I mean, obviously, in this podcast, we're focusing primarily on what GPs can do both in the clinical room and the consulting room and in their practice. But, you know, we do hear on the news a lot about the UK not doing so well in terms of cancer. Is there any kind of thoughts on that, why that could be, or where we could try and aim to get to?
Yeah, this has been a long-term thing, and the gap between us and sister countries, predominantly in Europe, where most of the comparisons are taken, is narrowing for some cancers, in particular breast. The gap has almost disappeared. It's not fully understood why the difference is present. Candidate possibilities are that patients are more reluctant to attend general practice with a symptom. And of course, the solution to that is, or one solution is, awareness campaigns. And then once they're in the consulting room, there was a sort of reluctance to raise cancer as a possibility and a reluctance to investigate. Again, I'm only speculating. And the answer to that was to give GP tools to help them to select patients for investigation. And then there were other downstream factors. Was secondary care able to accommodate demand of patients with possible cancer and then offer the treatments that they required? It was very difficult to tease out among those I've just raised four possibilities. There were others. Which one was the big one? But certainly diagnostics was clearly accepted as being one of the areas where we were behind the curve. And that's been lovely for me, because that's a field I've worked in now for nearly 25 years.
Yeah, and obviously you've changed the guidelines. So a lot of the work you've done and been involved with in other teams has changed those NICE guidelines. So we've potentially lowered the threshold to refer. And we have seen an increase in how GPs use 2-week wait. So I guess you could say that is a kind of primary care success story.
We've moved from fewer than 1 million 2-week wait appointments a year when their two-week waits were invented to over 2 million currently. Now, that's only a success if we're referring the right people. And to an extent, we are. I think the best metric of success, well, there's two. One is the proportion of the total cancers in a country that are detected by the optimum route. And that detection percentage is slowly creeping upwards in this country. So patients are getting to their cancer diagnosis by an optimum pathway more frequently than they did. And the second one that sort of measures the end result of that is the one that was brought in NHS plan of the proportion of patients that are identified at stage one or stage two compared with stage three or stage four. And again, that percentage of total cancers is creeping up. It's in the low 50s. And we're targeting to get it to 75% by 2028, which is going to be an almighty challenge. Success, but lots more work to do.
Lots of more work to do. And thinking, I guess the quick wins we've had is sort of the PPV, which, you know, positive predictive value, as you nicely defined there, Willie, around the sort of red flag symptoms, and we've been doing more referrals on those. But I think some of your work shows there is still a bit of variation, and we could improve even with those existing red flag symptoms.
Yeah, this was surprising, Tom, and it's a paper using relatively recent data. I had the perhaps completely naive assumption that the red flag symptoms were buttoned down. I mean, I think every GP in the land knows the red flag symptoms. I don't think there's any education required on that. But not every GP in the land is acting on the red flag symptoms. Now, I can understand that. I see patients who are describing change in bowel habit. And it's just something inside you says, this is low risk. It just doesn't feel like the change in bowel habit that comes from a colorectal cancer. But GPs are choosing not to refer some patients with red flag symptoms. And what's interesting is if you look at this, when GPs refer patients with red flag symptoms, and I'm talking about rectal bleeding, hemoptysis, breast lump, hematuria, I'm talking about really hardcore red flag symptoms, then the cancer risk in those who are referred is about 9 or 10%. And the cancer risk in those who are not referred is still just over 3%. So the GP selection process is working, but only working up to an extent. And those who they're choosing not to refer are still at what I think most people would say is non-acceptably high risk of cancer. So we need to change the dial a bit as GPs in that decision not to refer some patients who NICE says we should refer.
And is there any evidence certain groups are maybe not getting referred? So I know maybe some evidence that people, maybe English is not their first language, or there might be sudden barriers, you know, people with comorbidities or elderly patients that maybe we should be more actively maybe thinking about diagnostic testing.
Yeah, they're interesting groups that you pick up. I mean, let's talk about language, or let's switch it to ethnicity if we can. There is certainly emerging evidence that patients in minority ethnic groups do badly in some cancers. Now, whether that's diagnostic or whether it's intrinsic, certainly there is more prostate cancer in the Black community, for instance. So it's definitely an area where I think we GPs need to be extra vigilant in a patient from a minority group with a symptom that might be possible cancer. They're starting from a poor base in terms of the stats aren't on their side. So that's one side of it. Is there ageism? To an extent, there may be ageism that may be patient-driven. I mean, there is still the patient in their 80s or 90s who said, doctor, I've had a good innings. Don't refer me and I'll take my chances. And yeah, that's their choice. So there is something going on. Comorbidities is more complicated. We have a big research program going on in comorbidities. And comorbidities can work both ways. They can either speed up your diagnosis, which is good news, or they can delay it. So we're trying to unpick which comorbidity cancer pairs are the ones to focus on. But I agree with you that there are factors playing on that referral decision which can work in the patient's favour or can work against them.
And then you gave that example about the colorectal bleeding. So I think you co-signed recently a paper, Willie, which went out to all GPs and practices about using FIT testing. And actually, a little plug, actually, we've got a FIT testing module coming out on the RCGP website, which will be going through the guidelines on this. So just, I guess, a little nugget there about using the FIT test before referral.
Yeah, FIT is an extremely fast-moving subject. It was first brought in for the low-risk community, the patient in whom the GP thought cancer was a possibility, the bellyache, the very minor weight loss, the mild diarrhea, the bit of constipation, the patient in whom you really couldn't justify a two-week wait referral. And then FIT had very good performance characteristics. What came in the pandemic was that secondary care started using FIT to triage the high-risk patients, the referred population. And no surprise, FIT worked in that community. And what's happening now is, well, look, if FIT works in the low-risk community and works in the high-risk community, why don't we chuck out this artificial division between high-risk and low-risk? And ask GPs just to use FIT in patients in whom colorectal cancer is a possibility, the so-called pan-risk strategy. And that is being researched hard at present. NICE are also sitting on this, and there will be new guidance on this. And the BSG, the British Society of Gastroenterology, have brought out guidance largely based on secondary care, but they hope primary care will read it. Again, moving towards this pan-FIT strategy. But I don't want to get in the way of your podcast on FIT, but I think pan-risk is the way forward.
That's really good. And then I guess thinking about, you know, the evolving research, so FIT, you know, that's a test that's being hopefully I think all GPs can hopefully order it. And I can see that, the test rates have gone up, and I think it's a good evidence-based test. From your work and other researchers, is there any other good tests that you'd recommend? I think CA125, there's been quite a bit of work for ovarian.
Yeah, it is. CA125, I've always been pro CA125. It sounds like I've got shares in it. I don't. CA125 was brought in 2012 by NICE. And to be honest, I thought it was a bonkers decision at that time because there was no primary care evidence behind that decision. Rather irritatingly for me, they were completely correct because good primary care evidence is now available. Garth Funston's paper, I'm a minor author on that paper, really examined the performance characteristics of CA125, and it's as good as FIT. It's as good as chest X-ray. It really performs much better than I think we thought. Many, many countries in the world simply reject CA125. The Scandinavian countries won't touch it with a barge pole because they think it doesn't work. Well, we've shown the wrong. But one other interesting thing that came out with CA125 was that the one-size-fits-all threshold of 35 international units per litre, that actually in a young woman with that figure, the chance of ovarian cancer is actually pretty tiny. Whereas in an older woman with that figure, the chance is quite large. So there is a move, which NICE haven't yet grabbed, to move to a age-related threshold. And finally, before we leave CA125, a fascinating thing that Garth discovered in his paper was that for every ovarian cancer you identified with a RAE CA125, there was another non-ovarian cancer, usually intra-abdominal. So a RAE CA125 is a sort of blunt marker that there might be a cancer around. So if your patient really has ongoing symptoms, particularly loss of weight or these vagus symptoms that made you think of ovary, and you get a RAE CA125 and it turns out not to be ovary, it's worth contemplating the idea of other cancers, particularly intra-abdominal ones, to explain the patient's symptoms.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Thank you, Willie. And I should just do a little plug also. We'll be having a cancer detection module where we'll be going through in quite a lot of detail about the different tests. So, you know, we'll cover a little bit about Jess Watson's work on inflammatory markers. We'll go kind of in detail into some of the testing and when to think about testing in primary care.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, we have to sort of bunched together inflammatory markers, thrombocytosis, hypercalcemia, as tests that GPs do relatively frequently, but often without thinking of cancer. And then you get a surprising result back. Lox, the calcium's 2.8, or the viscosity's 1.8, or the platelet count is 500. What's going on? And in each of these, we've now published the relationship with cancer, but for all these ones, for the three that I've listed, well, for particularly for thrombocytosis and for raised calcium, the risk of cancer is quite high. Whereas in Jess Watson's work on inflammatory markers, the risk is there, but not as high.
Yeah, that's really, really useful. Thank you. So, I mean, as I say, we'll be, please do look at the module, which we'll go through in a bit more detail, each of these and some of the evidence base. I want to bring the discussion now onto, you mentioned a bit about the non-specific symptoms. And I think that's where there's a lot of work. You know, we talked about getting the red flags right. And yes, we could do a bit better on that. But, you know, it's the non-specific symptoms, which I think is the real tricky bit. And that's where our sort of primary care radar and our gut feeling comes into play, doesn't it?
It does, and it's real. Intuition is real, Tom. You know that. I know that. Can we just clarify what we mean by non-specific symptoms? In the cancer world, we use it to mean the symptom that may represent cancer, but doesn't specifically tie up to one particular type of cancer. So the opposite of a non-specific symptom is a breast lump. You know, if it's cancer, it's breast. Rectal bleeding, if it's cancer, it's colon. If it's weight loss, unless you've got other clues, then there's a whole host of possible cancers. The same goes for abdominal pain, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it's about one third of the cancers in this country initially begin with a non-specific symptom. So this isn't some sort of recondite thing for researchers. This is real for GPs. It's difficult. Clearly, you can get to a deeper understanding of the possibility of cancer by a full full examination and history taking. That sometimes gives you enough clues. But if you don't have clues, there are various ways of proceeding. Primary care investigation is relatively limited. Most GPs would do a chest X-ray. Most GPs would do a FIT. Then you start to wonder whether there should be specialist investigations. This brings us to the topic of rapid diagnostic centers. Yeah. And if I'm getting ahead of myself here, Tom, please stop me. RDCs were brought in to try and capture this population, to identify patients in cancer in this patient group. And they're working, almost working too well, in as much as those that are starting to report figures are getting cancer detection rates of 10 or 11%. Now, I say that's working too well. That suggests that actually it's a super selected population, that if the cancer risk is over one patient in 10, then are we failing to send some patients to these RDCs who would benefit from it? It does seem the system works. You get rapid testing done by the specialists who've got the fingertips and all the buttons needed to press. But should we be a bit more liberal in our referrals?
Yeah, and I think it's super interesting if you look at the comparisons for diagnostic capacity. A good example I always think about is Australia. We have people that, you know, friends that work there. They don't need RDCs because they've got much more CT access. So in a way, I kind of think it's a bit kind of facilitating us to access CT scans if I'm kind of thinking in that kind of. But also, I guess, all other serious pathology as well. It's not just cancer, right? It's other serious diseases which we could potentially pick up.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, diagnostic capacity is crucial, and there's been a long-standing debate as to whether GPs should have access to CT. And there is patchy access around the country. Scotland seems to get a lot of CT availability. In other areas, it's simply at the whim of secondary care, as far as I can see. And I can understand that these are expensive imaging techniques, and that they do take time, and they don't want them used indiscriminately. Against that, we GPs are by large pretty sharp. If I honestly think my patient needs a CT of the head because there's a small chance of a brain tumor, isn't it in everybody's interest if I can go ahead and order it myself? Total investigation capacity is lower in this country. We have fewer radiologists, and that is one real block. We do fewer colonoscopies. It doesn't feel like it to secondary care, but we do fewer colonoscopies than our sister countries. So expanding these services is a national priority. I say that in an NHS which is strapped for cash, of course.
Yes, and everyone's kind of stretched and overburdened. And I guess people do worry a little bit about over-testing and over-diagnosis. Do you have any kind of thoughts in that area?
I'm sometimes a bit glib on over-diagnosis in the symptomatic cancer field. For the listeners, over-diagnosis is where you identify a condition that wouldn't actually have mattered during the patient's lifetime disappear. So for the CT scan and the head that I've just ordered 5 minutes ago can identify little things inside the brain which have no importance. So in the symptomatic field, by and large, over-diagnosis is pretty minor. There's a bit of it in the melanoma field, in that we're seeing melanoma rates continue to go up, but melanoma deaths flatline. That could be that we're being really successful and we're cutting off what's an increasing number of melanomas and saving patients' lives. Or it could be that we're cutting off too many melanomas that don't matter, or labeling things differently. So overdiagnosis is a pretty small, but not zero, worry in the symptomatic cancer field. It's a much bigger worry in the screening field.
Yes, exactly. I think I agree with you on that. And, you know, going back a bit about this non-specific patient with us, we mentioned about gut feeling. So there is quite a good evidence base on gut feeling. And I know lots of people doing research on this. I mentioned Brian and Claire at Oxford University.
Yeah, this... It's a difficult field to research because it's quite difficult to define what gut feeling is. I personally prefer the term intuition, but like gut feeling is used a lot. And yeah, what is it that we GPs add to the equation? Well, I mean, I think we can be simple that medicine is not just painting by numbers, and general practice is certainly not painting by numbers. So the NICE guidance had to be, if this, do that. And we deliberately wrote into the front of the NICE guidance, use your intuition, use your wisdom, use your experience to apply these rules. And that wasn't a get out of jail free card for GPs. That was asking GPs to just use their experience. We're highly qualified doctors, and it seems to work in the studies that have reported it. But if I'm honest, as a scientist, the studies are still fairly poor. And I'm not being rude to Brian and our Dutch colleagues have done it, just because the definition of intuition is so difficult to button down.
But yeah, I think they did in the Dutch study or the Danish study, they looked at the sort of put actual PPV onto gut feeling, if I can recall seeing the paper.
Yeah, but I mean, some of these papers have the gut feeling in a woman with a breast lump. To be honest, it's not the gut feeling that's driving this, it's the breast lump that's driving this. So Tom, I'm happy for us to sort of mildly disagree. Actually, we don't disagree with the basic idea that intuition works. I mean, that earlier figure I gave you of GPs selecting patients with red flags and getting nearly 10% in those they do refer and getting just over 3% in those they don't refer. There you are. That shows that GPs can select. What it doesn't say is that GP selection is perfect. Intuition works. It's just the science is tricky.
Yeah. Thanks, Willie. So we have focused most of this podcast talking about what we can do in our kind of clinical encounters, but I want to sort of also think about what we could do in the wider sort of practice, you know, within our practice, maybe within primary care networks or larger organisations. And I'm thinking there around, you know, obviously we've got a very stretched GP workforce, so there is a lot to be done before a patient gets to us.
Yeah, there is. I mean, we've got a stretched GP workforce, and I'm not in the game of trying to make it any more difficult for GPs in the slightest. What I do think is that cancer diagnostics is one of the core areas within general practice. And I think if we're honest, and you and I went out for a drink after this podcast, and I'd say, what's one of the core functions of general practice? You'd say cancer diagnostics. And it wasn't just because you were talking to me. I think you'd say that to anybody. So I don't feel bad about us trying to help general practice to identify their patients with cancer. It's how can we do it within practice, having these regular meetings to talk about it, having perhaps diagnostic tools on your computer that help, having smooth mechanisms for follow-up of results. We all hear these horror stories of abnormal results not being acted upon. It's having a good mechanism for safety netting, which we haven't touched on yet, Tom. Of the patients that I see and I think the risk of cancer is so low that I don't need to do anything, but I'm not absolutely sure. Some mechanism whereby that patient and I make a repeat decision on that, on them in a month's time. And maybe the symptoms are gone and there's no decision needs to be made. But it's some sort of recall system that is fail-safe, I think, is crucial. Most GPs have it, but it has to be watertight.
Yeah, and I think the national audit showed, you know, this is obviously documented in the notes, it was about 45% of cancer patients had some safety netting documented. So that's certainly an area we could do more on. And again, it's an area we're going to focus on in the online learning module as well. We have some safety netting tools, both within the consultation, as you mentioned, but also as a wider within your primary care system. I give an example, a lot of practices have a two-week wait safety netting mechanism, often run by the admin team. So in my practice, I refer, but they will make sure the patient does have an appointment, make sure they don't DNA, make sure they understand what the appointment is for. I think that's really crucial. If we're referring people in, we do explain a little bit about what that referral means and the importance of going in and having tests. Or again, like if we were doing a fit test, I think it's really important to ensure safety netting for getting the bloods or the fit test or the chest x-ray as an example.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. There is a significant percent of patients offered a fit test who do not do it. I've got a small research grant with colleagues in Newcastle to look at exactly why I'm trying to tease out what's going on. But to have a practice system whereby some alert is triggered if the fit test isn't returned within an agreed period, I think would be very helpful. Yeah, so all these matter, Tom.
I guess now summing up, you know, we focus on quite a few areas for GPs, you know, just thinking here towards the end of the podcast, any sort of top tips from our discussion today, you know, that sort of takeaway nuggets for clinicians into their practice?
Yeah, I think the answer is trust yourself. GPs are highly experienced people and they have the patient in front of them, listening to them. And able to put their hand in their tummy. Trust yourself, but don't trust yourself completely. If you're left with concern that there is a cancer there, make the referral. So that's coming back to the intuition thing. Yes, use the NICE guidelines, and the NICE guidelines aren't bad. And that, you know, the mere fact that they haven't been revised in 7 years sort of suggests we got it pretty well right. So if in doubt, refer. But that's what you're doing because the two-week wait numbers are creeping up. And remember, we're getting it right. Cancer survival figures are improving in this country. Stage of diagnosis is creeping better. The proportion of patients presenting with an emergency presentation is dropping. So GPs are getting it right. We just need to keep getting it right even more.
That's really good. Thank you, Willie. And I guess a plug to say, please do see our RCGP online learning. So we'll be covering in much more detail cancer detection. It'll be a two-part module. We also have some modules on fit testing. We do have modules on the NICE two-week wait guidelines. Please do have a look at those and some other. We'll have lots of resources on there as well for you. Thank you so much, Willie, for your time today. Really do appreciate the discussion. And I hope you listening found that interesting. Thanks, Willie.
And Tom, lovely to speak to you. And I hope all goes well.
Thank you very much. Take care and thanks for listening to RCGP podcasts.